Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hear me? Can you hear me on the phone?
I do. I've got you coming out of every orifice.
I'm really not, you're breaking up quite badly.
Hello and welcome to The Lock-In, where I finally get to talk to people I want to hear from in a place I want to be, the pub.
For some reason, this bloody thing has started playing back some rubbish.
Oh, right.
Where were we? I forgot.
I have too.
Locked in with us today is Hilary McGrady, who's the Director General of the National Trust. This sounds an agreeable enough post. Lots of splendid big houses to look after, along with beautiful countryside and accountable only to the organisation's millions of members. A bit like being a national fairy godmother, except that it's been taking a lot of incoming flak for the last year or so. Lockdown has meant it's only got a fraction of its normal number of visitors. It's in the red, it's been accused of perpetuating one of the most damaging assaults on art historical expertise ever seen in the UK by one art critic, as it reorganises itself, and it's outraged much of its membership by investigating the links between places in its care and slavery. What are you trying to do, Hilary McGrady?
Very interesting when you listen to that intro, Jeremy. I'll come to what I was trying to do before COVID happened, but since a lot of what you've just talked about relates to this last year, what I am absolutely 100% focused on is making sure that not only the National Trust survives this, and there was definitely a moment where I was wondering if I was going to be the Director General that would see the demise of the National Trust. But I am now confident that we will not only survive this, but we will thrive at the outcome. But that has taken up my every waking hour, actually. And so the things that you've just referred to have absolutely been challenging, enormously challenging. But they do not compare to the priority that I had to put on making sure that the organisation was financially sustainable, that I was able to maintain as many of the brilliant staff that I currently have, and that we will come out of this in a shape that will mean that the millions of people who have actually still been able to enjoy our open spaces and have taken great succour actually during this awful year, that they can continue to enjoy the places that we look after and that they can engage in the history that actually is so important in this country. So that was my priority, but I'm really happy to take questions on.
How big a hole are you in?
Well, because of all sorts of things, way back in April, we estimated that we thought we would lose in and around, and at the time I said 200 million this year. And that was on the back of having to close, obviously, so all our shops, our cafes and so on. And also in terms of knowing what the impact would be on our membership, that we would lose in and around 200. It's actually turned out to be slightly more than that, but because of primarily the support from government through furlough and through the various schemes that they put in place, also our own decision to make really very significant cuts to our staff. So we had to lose about 1,500 of our staff, and that accounted for about 60 million. We had to find another 40 million in terms of just cost cutting. So we're not in a hole. I'm, in fact, because of all of those things, government support and our own good, I think, and sound decisions, we are going to be all right. And at the end of this, I intend to come out, yes, a bit smaller, but we're going to come out fighting, actually. And we're going to come out in a place where we can help more people recover from this terrible year.
How many visitors are you down this year?
Well, I mean, we are running at about 30% of our normal visits at the moment. And don't forget, that's only because of restrictions, obviously. That's only to our outdoor sites. Our houses are still closed and will be until the middle of May. We've had to introduce a booking system to ensure that we retained all the social distancing and everything that went with the regulations. So we're running at about 30% at the moment. But what that doesn't count for, those are the people that would normally come to what we would call our pay for entry places. What that doesn't account for is millions of people who are walking our coastlines, walking our mountains, walking along the amazing countryside. That we can't count. But of course, we don't derive an income from that. What we do is care for it and make sure that people can continue to access it. And thankfully, they have.
Just as a matter of interest, those boxes that you have on bits of coastline and up in the hills, do you get much money out of them?
No, no, people think you do, but no, you don't. I mean, they are there primarily to remind people that we are a charity and that we do need support. And these places don't come free. People think the countryside's free and it really isn't. So all the paths that are maintained, the stiles that are looked after, the signage that keeps you safe, all of those things take time. They take people, they take effort, they take money. We derive the vast majority of our income through membership. Massively important to us, and people giving us money, which I have to say, in a year that's been so challenging for so many people, loads of people have supported us through online giving and just sending in donations. So your point about we've lost loads of members, you know, on the back of things like our slavery report, actually, I'm really proud that our membership base has held up as well as it has.
Well, there have been a lot of complaints from members.
There has. You always have to put this in context. We've over 5 million members, and we had, I think, I can't actually remember the exact number, but it was in and around 500 letters of everything from, you know, outraged complaint through to, I'm really not sure I understand what's going on here. Could you help me? And so that is a sizable number. Anybody that has an issue with trust, I take seriously. But I need to put it in context that out of, you know, well over 5 million, we were 1 week off 6 million members before COVID hit, which is a matter of deep regret for me that we didn't quite get there. And so, not surprisingly, we have lost members, mostly because we haven't been able to recruit. You know, we haven't been open. So we always lose members for all sorts of different reasons, but we always can recruit more than we lose. But because we haven't been open, we've struggled to recruit. Although, thankfully, in the last month, recruitment has started to grow again, which is a huge relief to me.
These complaints were mainly about the slavery campaign, were they?
Yeah, that particular... I had two batches. I don't particularly want to invoke either of them again, but I had two batches. The first was in response to the redundancy programme, and we did have a small but very vocal group who were very concerned that we had in some way pulled apart our conservation, particularly our house conservation team. As it happens, we had to, from a financial point of view, we had to make redundancies, and all parts of the organisation had to take some element of cut. We tried as far as we could to ring fence our curatorial teams, and they were significantly less impacted than most other parts of the organisation. We took, I think, something like 30% away from marketing, for example, whereas curatorial was about 9%. Nonetheless, people in the curatorial community were, and I can understand, really concerned that we had done something, you know, terminal to our curatorial team. I genuinely don't think we have. I regret losing anybody. That was never my intention. So any loss of staff or volunteers, for that matter, is a matter of regret for me. But what we did do was try to make sure that we retained expertise where we needed it most. And so our really big, important houses, treasure houses, we've actually increased the level of curatorial support they'll get. And we have looked to make sure that our smaller houses and less important collections will also get cared for through a different structure.
How many jobs are you going to lose?
It'll be just over 1,500 once it's all sort of washed through, which out of a workforce at the start of COVID, we had over 12,000 full-time equivalent staff. So we'll have lost about 1,500 out of that, which is a big old drop. But having said that, it feels massive. And certainly if you were on the receiving end of it, very, very, very painful. But it takes us back to about our levels of 2017, 18. We went through a really rapid growth over the last two or three years. So, you know, we are still a very big force for good in the cultural sector. And as I say, I'm very confident now. Not only are we, you know, going to be okay financially, assuming that we continue on the trajectory that we're all on at the moment, I'm hopeful that we'll be okay at the end of this.
But when you hear people like Grosvenor Bender, I mean, it's a serious chap, isn't it? Or Stephen Bailey or whatever, talking about the damage that you're doing to curatorial resources. What do you think?
Well, I mean, I've spoken to Bender a number of times. You know, Bender, I regard him and absolutely respect the work that he does. In both of my conversations, I think he did acknowledge the reasons why we were making the changes we were making. And he also understood that we were absolutely trying to make sure that we retained expertise where we needed it most. And in fact, have, as I said, gone to lengths to make sure that the places that need the most care are getting actually additional support instead of less. So completely within their rights to hold us to account. We're a big old organisation that, you know, are, you know, very well understood in the curatorial world. I would always say, judge us by our actions, not by our words. So if you go, we have, in the last 5 years, we've spent more on conservation and more on our houses than we ever have before. And I have every intention of maintaining that sort of support, particularly on our collections over the next number of years. So, you know, when you go to our houses, I would challenge you to say that you can see that we've, you know, done something dreadful and that our houses are less well looked after. They'll not be. That is absolutely my commitment.
Why did you bother with the slavery investigation?
Well, we're a serious heritage organisation. And since the day we were formed, we have investigated the history of our properties. That's what we do. And I'm very pleased to say that the Charity Commission did actually finally acknowledge that, 2 weeks ago, that to research our history was entirely valid. Good. Tick. So what we wanted to do and will always do is make sure that we tell all of our history, not just the bits that we feel comfortable with. And really, this isn't new. We started to look into our connections with slavery way back in 2007, with the anniversary of abolition of slavery. We started that process. It was centred around Penryn in Wales at the time. But since then, we've been doing lots of research into this, usually property by property. And what we had concluded in 2017 was what we lacked was an organisational view. So an individual property view, but not from an organisation. So we commissioned this report to try to get a global view across all of our properties as to what the connections were. So this was well before Black Lives Matter, well before COVID, and has long term, you know, for a long time been in the burn. I should say it sat alongside research into World War One. It sat along research into connections with suffrage and all of these other subjects equally being looked into. Now, this one is a motive. I absolutely recognise it. It's a motive, but it's important to state that we did it as part of a long-term research ambition to make sure that we tell all of the stories about all of our properties. And, you know, the idea that it was some sort of politically motivated thing was just nonsense, frankly.
But nobody believes that this country has got clean hands when it comes to slavery. We don't. We do have clean hands with the suppression of slavery, but we don't have clean hands with slavery itself. Why hadn't anyone looked into this before in the National Trust?
Yeah, no, that's a good challenge, and I've actually been pondering that one myself. You know, let's be honest, this has, we all know, this is a difficult subject. Just look what the trust has been put through in the last 2 or 3 months. It's not surprising that we were a bit, you know, cautious around it. And I've been thinking about it. I think it was a combination of factors that we haven't looked into this more fully. I think we come from a very conservative place ourselves as an organisation, you know, with very conservative values. I think there was an element for years about deference to our the families that gave us the houses. So we were definitely concerned, and rightly so, to want to work with them. And I think genuinely we were worried about what members would think, about what the public would think. And I suppose across all of those, you know, you have to mature, don't you? You have to recognise that actually it's not in the interest of anybody to try to cover up stories, to cover up history. And history should be interesting to everybody. One of the things that I think has people have tried to peddle here is that we're trying to appease one minority. We're not. I'm guessing you're interested in this history. I'm interested in this history. It should be something that we should all want to know about. And it's about adding to our understanding. Not this stupid notion of whitewashing or trying to erase history. I just don't get it, because you're adding to it. You're embellishing it. And I think that's got to be a good thing, doesn't it?
But the accusation is that you've done it because you're woke.
I know. And what do, you know, what can I say about that?
Are you woke?
I'm not woke. What I am is interested in telling all of the history of our properties. And, you know, this thing about woke is really, you know, it leaves you nowhere to go, because it immediately puts you on the back foot. Oh, I'm not going to do this. I'm not going to do that. I'm honestly not interested in that stuff. I am interested in telling really interesting stories about our properties. I want people to come and learn about their history and understand where they might be connected or not connected. I think history plays a massively important part of rooting people in their communities, understanding where they came from to help inform their future, all of that good stuff. And the Trust does that so brilliantly well. And you know what? What really winds me up is this idea that the public, when they come to our houses, will only get one story. What a load of nonsense. If you go to Quarry Bank Mill, it's a brilliant example, you know, tells an amazing story of the industrial heritage, tells an amazing story of what, you know, what some of the founding stories of Manchester. It has so much to tell that feels good. It also tells about child labour. It also tells about slavery. And the great British public are entirely capable of taking all of that and making sense of it. And they might even have a cup of tea and walk around the garden and enjoy that too at the same time. Why we think we have to nanny them and, you know, tell them you read this but you don't read that is just ridiculous. So I am very confident that my members, and more importantly the public at large, go to these places and allow all of that to wash over them, and they go with an overall sense of what story they have heard, not one particular story.
Do you worry your members are getting old?
No, I love the fact they're getting old, because it means that they've got more time to spend at our places. That has got to be a good thing. And similarly, volunteers. People have time once they retire, and I think that's a great thing. Having said that, on volunteering in particular, over 30% of our volunteers are now what we would call younger people, because they want to engage with the work.
What do you call younger?
Well, I'm talking more in the range of about 25 to 30. Typically, graduates coming out of uni or just young people wanting to engage, particularly around environmental issues. So we're seeing the face of volunteering changing. But that's, you know, I think, that, again, the Trust can accommodate all of that. And I think that's the joy of the Trust, that we've got a little bit of something for everybody, really.
If I had to, and I say this as a grey-haired man, but if I had to say what is the dominant hair colour of visitors to National Trust properties, I would say it was grey.
Yeah, no, it is. That's because you've got a bit of time, or I don't know how busy you are, Jeremy, actually. But, it doesn't take, you know, the brain of Britain to figure out that if you've got a bit of time, you've got time to go to visit National Trust properties. I would say at the minute, and it's partly because we're benefiting from the lovely baby boomers, people are retiring earlier, so they've got more time in their hands. And so you're seeing actually our main age group at the minute is between 55 and 65. So it's getting younger year on year, which is an interesting shift. What we are finding is that older people are coming during the week, younger families are coming at the weekend. So people are choosing when they want to come to the trust and when it feels right for them.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
What about this quote, which you will doubtless claim has been taken out of context from one of your internal reports, that we must flex our mansion offer to create more active, fun and useful experiences? What on earth is all that about?
Yeah, fair cop. Every organisation has its own lingo. And when I read that again, of course I can make sense of it because I understand what they're trying to say. Basically, it means we want to make sure that not every property feels the same, that we want to make sure that if you go to, I don't know, what I would call a treasure house like Kettleston or Knoll, that you'll get a really in-depth story of the history and an amazing collection. But you might also want to go somewhere like Attingham, where the collection is less important, but the outdoors is amazing. So we're being flexible in terms of the kind of place that you might get at the Trust. Probably 20 years ago, every trust property would have felt very similar. So that's all that means. But fair cop, I can see the language is trust speak. Simon Jenkins, when he was our chairman, used to give me terrible stick about trust language like that. But it was an internal document. In our defence, it was an internal document that was leaked.
But you'd speak to yourself in jargon.
Oh, look, to be honest, if you were to go to any retailer, they would talk about flexible offer. They would talk about experience. These words make sense in specific contexts. I can see completely why other people would look at it and say, "What does that mean?" You know.
Do you have any sense? What about this other thing about dialing down your national cultural institution role?
Yeah, so it is important. Actually, you're quite right. I will put this report in context. When COVID hit and we had to really think about what were we going to do with less money, less resource, et cetera, how are we going to manage in that new scenario? We commissioned the team concerned to say, well, how are we going to deal with our houses in this new context? And they came back, it was an internal document, and they were specifically asked to be provocative, you know, think of everything that might happen here, from the worst case scenario that we have to close everything to the best case scenario that everything reopens the way it was before and everything in between. And in that, they put lots of different options to us. You know, you can do this, you could do that, you might, you know, and some of it we agreed with and a lot of it we didn't agree with. That document was subsequently leaked then by someone who was put at risk through the redundancy programme. And it was a matter of massive regret for me because it was, you know, incredibly challenging at the time. But that's the context. So in that dialing up, dialing down thing, and you would need to see the whole thing, one of the proposals was that we would try to be more like some of the big, you know, national museums. And actually we said, we're not trying to be a big national museum. We do actually have the biggest collection, and I would argue most important collection, in the UK, but we're not a big V&A or a British Museum. So that was one of the things that we said, actually, we're not trying to be them. What we are trying to make sure is that people get the very best experience they can in whatever way they want, depending on the property. So that is just an example of, will we dial down trying to be this big, you know, institution, or are we more interested in that sort of local experience that you would get when you go to whichever property?
You mentioned a local experience. The accusation against the National Trust used always to be that everywhere turns out to look the same.
Yeah.
Have you tried to get rid of that?
Yes, that's exactly what we are trying to get rid of. The idea that every property had a blueprint and you got exactly the same thing, frankly, I'm not sure that anybody liked that. So this thing about being flexible entirely is about allowing each property to speak for itself and, you know, to bring its own history and its own personality forward instead of having a National Trust handprint all over it. So over time, that's exactly what we would like to do, to allow that local sense of property to come through more effectively.
So how are you going to do that?
We are going to be more careful around which properties we treat in what way. So the big treasure houses, so if you think of Knowle, if you think of Hardwick, places like Chartwell, these really big iconic sites, we're putting in curators, individual curators. They didn't have their own curator before. They're going to have their own. And we're going to focus on what's the most important thing for that property. So Churchill clearly is the most important aspect of Chartwell. Whereas Knowle, it's actually more to do with the collection. It's also Vita's story, but it's mostly collection. So really making sure that we're pulling out the thing that's most important to that property and not trying to identicate all of them to the same standard. And there may be some properties that, you know, we do a lot less on the collection, but we do a lot more on programming there, or outdoor offer, for example, something like that. So we're just being much more specific about the place and how we make that place come to life.
How enthusiastic are they going to be allowed to be?
Well, as ever with the Trust, we always are mindful that we still do operate as an overall organisation. So we are clear in terms of where are the red lines, where would we not want you to, you know, to get too far ahead of yourself. You still have to stay true to the spirit of the place, to the history of the place, and to the characters involved. So, you know, I would say we are careful and respectful of the history at all properties, but we do want the personality of the places to come through. And that's what volunteers would tell us they want. That's what local people would say they want as well.
Yeah, I mean, it seems to me that what sells me on a place is when you hear someone describing, and you'll never guess what happened over here, that sort of thing.
Exactly, that's exactly right. And it's those little stories that really bring it to... I mean, if most of us have been bored senseless, being dragged around historic houses, and there's another painting and another painting and another painting, and it means nothing. But actually, those stories of such and such a person did this, and actually that meant that, you know, so they married whatever, that starts to help you really understand why this property is here, how it came around, where the connections were to all the other houses around the country. Yeah, so that's exactly what we're trying to do. We'll not do it overnight, by the way. These things take a bit of time and research, and that is partly why, just to go back to the slavery thing, we have to continue to research into all of these sort of hidden areas that we haven't before, and that is why I was relieved with the Charity Commission's final report.
Yeah, let me ask you a little about that. Hanbury Strategy, why have you hired them?
So we obviously did find ourselves in a bit of a pickle, didn't we? And that was October. I was getting it, you know, I was getting brickbats left, right and centre for all sorts of things. And in particular, the Conservative Party were absolutely outraged with us, let's be honest. Or sorry, I should say a number of the Conservative Party were definitely outraged. And, you know, I'm a big believer in, you know, if you're hitting your head against a wall and it starts to hurt, you should stop. And so we stopped and thought, we need to really think carefully here about how we're building the relationships. If I had my time again, the slavery report, absolutely the right thing to do, absolutely the right commission. Timing wise, not brilliant, in the middle of trying to deal with COVID and everything else. But it was already in commission, it had already been written. the people involved knew that it had been written. You know, there was massive pressure to get it out. I wasn't focused on that. I was focused on the COVID stuff. So we brought Hanbury on to simply help us work through that maze that we were dealing with at the time, and to stop hitting myself against a wall, frankly.
Do you accept you made mistakes?
My biggest mistake was publishing it when we did, because it got conflated with Black Lives Matter. That was the first thing. And it also, my organisation and I personally didn't have the bandwidth to do it well. So in any normal circumstances, had I been publishing a report like that, I would have spent weeks talking to stakeholders to prepare them for it. I would have been doing loads of work around it that I just didn't have the bandwidth to do. It was entirely the right thing to do to commission this research, and it's entirely the right thing to do to tell this history at our properties.
And entirely the right thing to do to include Wordsworth's home?
So, to see again, it's really interesting. This report was commissioned to help us as a baseline bit of research to help us understand where the connections were. So stage one, where is the connection? Stage two is, all right, we've established a connection. Now we'll go on, and if it's anything worth, you know, if there's any depth and merit to it, we'll then take that to the next stage. Some of the connections were so tangential that we won't follow them up. Some of them were, that's interesting, we might add it into the guidebook, but on we go. Some of them, actually, the connection to slavery is so fundamental to this property that we will do more on it. So Durham is a good example of that. I'm trying to think, Penryn is obviously a really good example of that. There's not that many, actually, of that category. So the mention of Wordsworth was purely, there's a connection. There is, but not mostly because they were actually abolitionists. So in that report, we talk about the abolitionists as well. It was purely about, is there a connection? The press, of course, wanted to make it out to be, this is some big flag waving thing that you're going to be slapped around the face every time you come into a property. And that's simply not the case. The information will be, once we research it further, embedded into, you know, the guidebooks if necessary. The volunteers will be briefed as to what the connections are. It'll be very gentle, and only if you want to find out, by the way, and only if you want to understand more yourself as a visitor.
How much is it costing you to hire Hanbury Strategy?
I don't know. I actually genuinely don't know. It's not a huge amount of money. In marketing terms, it's not a huge amount of money. And actually, they were only hired for a short period of time. We've actually finished the contract with them now. It's really normal for an organisation like us to work with PR agencies, and they're slightly different, a strategy agency. It's entirely normal for an organisation like ours to do that. And it was for a very defined and short space of time. And, you know, it is worth remembering, the National Trust reputation is hugely important to us, and from a financial point of view, incredibly important to us. So it's a good investment, as far as I'm concerned, to ensure that my reputation's protected, as much as is important to ensure that a collection's looked after.
But the trust has to be like Caesar's wife, doesn't it? Has to be above suspicion.
Indeed, and we work really hard to be transparent. I've always maintained I'm really happy to take and answer any questions. We're an independent charity, and that means that people need to know what we're spending our money on. I've always been open and honest about that, and I have no difficulty, and I'm happy to defend any of our spend.
Do you feel it's an old-fashioned organisation?
No, I do not. I think we couldn't be more contemporary. Can you think of an organisation better suited to what our nation needs of us right now? We've just come through this unholy, hideous year, and the National Trust has been able to provide a public benefit, I think, like virtually no other. I mean, obviously NHS is way out ahead of us, and potentially the BBC, but we've been here for when the nation has needed us most. People, I looked at statistics yesterday, there's been a rise of about 50% in the number of people accessing the outdoors during COVID that never did before. And actually, yeah, I think the other really interesting thing out of this is this sense of desire to reroute yourself, to understand your community, to feel part of something. And I think the Trust does that incredibly well. Again, this point about history, we're living through history at the moment. We're creating history, and the trust allows you the opportunity to root yourself back into what is your part in this community. How, you know, did you have a connection with our properties? Perhaps your parents' family worked there. Perhaps there's some other connection. Maybe you've got some lineage to the family that owned it. The trust plays a massive part in helping people understand how they got to be the place they're in. And I think our relevance has never been more vital than it is right now. And I feel really proud of that, actually, which is why I'm actually very confident that at the end of this, we will actually bounce back. I'm absolutely convinced of it. I'm going to build on that. The numbers of people coming into the outdoors. Yeah, it comes with its challenges. And if I had a ranger beside me now, they'd be saying, well, our paths are getting trashed and there are people leaving litter all over the place. I still embrace all that because ultimately they're getting out into the outdoors. They're thinking, actually, this is worth caring for. And maybe, just maybe, I'll do something to help. Maybe I'll litter pick, or maybe I'll, you know, be part of a bird count, or maybe I'll volunteer for the National Trust or the Wildlife Trust or whoever. So I think we have a lot to play for.
You know, the principle of this podcast was originally, when we first dreamed it up, was that we like going to the pub and being locked in with somebody.
Yes.
Now, you've got lots of pubs. Which one would you choose?
Oh, look, I am biased here. Where else could I say other than the Crown Bar in Belfast? There couldn't be a better one.
Well, I've got pissed in there already.
You and me both. Yeah. Oh, what a brilliant bar. Just fabulous. But you're right, we have bars all over the place. There's a great one, actually, called Stickle Barn in the Lake District, which is also just gorgeous. We've loads of them all over the place. They're lovely.
Well, I'm very grateful to you for sparing the time to talk to us. Thanks a lot.
I could talk for hours. And if you're over in Belfast, Jeremy, I'll meet you in the Crown. We can definitely have a pint of Guinness there.
That'd be good fun. We'll do that. Well, there you are. Hilary McGrady, the Director General of the National Trust. Come to think of it, I forgot to ask her about being the supremo, presiding over the largest output of scones and jam anywhere in the country. Next week, we've got Jake Fiennes, yet another distinguished member of the Fiennes clan, and no less accomplished in his own line of work, which happens to be the conservation and restoration of wild habitats, specifically on the Holcombe Estate in Norfolk. He's a man who knows his warblers from his robins, and we had a lovely chat about birdsong, birds, hedges, the important things in life. Do join us for that, and in the meantime, keep buggering on.
Small details are big surfaces. Tight corners are odd shapes. Flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.